Published time, September 13, 2016 12:48. The U.S. has reportedly agreed a $38 billion package to deliver military aid to Israel over the next 10 years, with the pact expected to be signed within days. The deal will become the biggest pledge of U.S. military assistance to another country in history. The new aid package will see Israel receive $3.8 billion per year from Washington, an increase of $700 million from the current $3.1 billion, sources told Reuters. However, the figure fell short of the annual $4.5 billion that Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu had been seeking. Following the negotiations, Israel says it will not seek extra funding from the U.S. A previous agreement that allowed Israel to spend just over a quarter of the aid given by Washington on weapons from its domestic defense industry, instead of from the U.S., will be also phased out. The terms of the deal, which is classed as a Memorandum of Understanding, MOU, will also include money for Israel's missile defense program. This had previously been funded by Congress on an informal basis. A source told Reuters that the pact is expected to be signed within days. However, the new MOU will not be signed between President Barack Obama and Netanyahu, who have had a frosty relationship due to the U.S. leader's support for last year's Iranian nuclear deal, which was bitterly opposed by Israel. Lower-ranking officials will sign the paperwork, as has been the case with previous deals. The plan for an increase in military aid to Israel has enjoyed strong support in Congress. In April, 83 U.S. Senators, 51 Republicans and 32 Democrats sent a letter to the White House urging an increase in financial support. The effort was spearheaded by South Carolina Republican Lindsey Graham and Delaware Democrat Chris Coons. In light of Israel's dramatically rising defense challenges, we stand ready to support a substantially enhanced new long-term agreement to help provide Israel the resources it requires to defend itself and preserve its qualitative military edge, the letter said. It is believed that Netanyahu agreed to the deal before November's U.S. presidential election to avoid uncertainties surrounding what will happen when the new leader takes office. Not everyone has been impressed with the military aid package set to be signed between the two allies. A Washington, D.C. nonprofit group is suing the U.S. government, challenging its authority to provide Israel with foreign aid and arguing that its status a nuclear power which did not sign the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty means that aiding it contravenes U.S. law. This lawsuit is not about foreign policy. It is about the rule of law, presidential power, the structural limits of the U.S. Constitution, and the right of the public to understand the functions of government and informed petition of the government for redress, stated the complaint filed by Grant F. Smith, director of the Institute for Research, Middle East Policy, IRMEP. It remains difficult to negotiate a settlement in Syria because many in the region feel the U.S. is only interested in regime change, author and historian Gerard Horn told RT. Syria's nationwide ceasefire began at 7 p.m. Damascus time, 1600 hours o'clock GMT, on Monday, the result of marathon talks between Russia and the U.S. last week. The Russian Defense Ministry says Moscow and the U.S. will create a joint center to define terrorist targets. The truce includes a cessation of hostilities and the creation of a demilitarized zone around Aleppo. The Syrian government has agreed to end airstrikes in some areas, avoiding opposition groups not linked to terror groups like al-Nusra or ISIS. If the ceasefire holds for at least a week, the United States and Russia will then work together to target terror groups. The agreement's initial aims also include allowing humanitarian access to the besieged areas. RT, now that a new milestone in terms of cooperation between the U.S. and Russia has been reached, how much, in your opinion, will it affect the situation in the region? Gerald Horn, let us hope that it has a positive effect in the region. I'm reminded of what President Obama said at the G20 meeting in China after his meeting with President Putin, when he said there was a trust gap between the two nations. He didn't mention that the origin of that trust gap rests with the ill-advised U.S. intervention in Libya, which the U.S. said was to protect civilians amid regime change. That poisoned the well of relations between Moscow and Washington, it poisoned the well of relations between the African Union and Washington. And it is also now troubling and disrupting an effort to get a settlement in Syria because many in the region feel the U.S. is interested in regime change. That is to say, deposing President Assad more so than getting a regional settlement and a peaceful settlement. RT, despite the steps taken together by the sides, some U.S. officials seem skeptical about the deal. What's your take on it? GH, I think it evades the central question. My understanding is that this new accord does not preclude Damascus from attacking ISIS-related forces or Al-Qaeda-related forces. The problem for the U.S. is that the so-called moderate rebels that they are supporting or backed are oftentimes integrated with the Al-Qaeda-backed forces. The State Department spokesperson was evading that question with his remarks. RT, the White House has been criticized for supporting questionable moderate opposition groups, such as Ahrar al-Sham, which have been involved in many cases of civilian casualties. Do you think it's fair for U.S. authorities to shift responsibility without cutting ties to groups that are continuing to disrupt peace in the country? GH, it's ironic that 24 hours after the solemn celebration in Washington, New York, and Pennsylvania marking the 15th anniversary of the Al-Qaeda attack on the U.S., that, as we speak, the U.S. is figuratively in bed with Al-Qaeda-like forces in Syria. This exposes, it seems to me, the contradiction and the hypocrisy of the U.S. foreign policy. RT, do you think it is possible to establish a new Syrian government with the contrasting visions the U.S. and Russia have for who should be put in power in the country? What steps do you think should be taken first in resolving this issue? GH, part of the problem is that a close U.S. ally, that is Saudi Arabia, wants to see the departure of the Assad regime in Damascus. Recall that up until recently and perhaps even now, Ankara also has wanted to see the departure of President Assad. Ankara, of course, is the southeastern flank of NATO dominated by the U.S. And given the fact that these two allies of Washington are seeking to oust President Assad, it's going to be very difficult to come to an agreement because, as Moscow suggests quite rightly, this should be the option for the Syrian people to decide who will govern them, not Saudi Arabia, not Turkey, and certainly not the US. Syria desperately needs a ceasefire and a political agreement is necessary to that. I have to say, on one side, America and Russia coming together with the support of the Assad government, with the support of Iran, means on that side a ceasefire will be a success. I think the problem comes from other players, like Turkey and Saudi Arabia in particular, who have armed and financed some of these groups, and are using many of them as satraps. Chris Bambury, political analyst RT, what can we expect further on the ground in Syria? GH, what I expect is the Assad regime to coordinate with Moscow, then Moscow in turn will coordinate with Washington. I guess that removes the alleged stain on Washington cooperating with Assad, who has been demonized not only in Washington, but by the so-called mainstream press of the U.S. That is quite a result where Damascus coordinates with Moscow, then Moscow coordinates with Washington may be the best that we can expect right now. The statements, views, and opinions expressed in this column are solely those of the author and do not necessarily represent those of RT.
Hi.
Seamus O'Connelly in Hobbs, New Mexico.
I recognized your voice.
And I did the same, sir. We are on the air, and thank you for joining me.
Thank you for inviting me.
Tom, I just read a sentence here from the Wireless Flash. And you are saying that the thing in Kosovo is actually a plot by the government to prevent the new European Union from controlling the world. Is that correct, sir?
Well, not necessarily the world, but it's obvious, and there's many academics have talked about this, that the European Union is coming on strong, and of course, recently, both England and I think France and a couple of them have dropped their taxes way down on big investors, and so EU is taking off like a rocket, and there are business interests in this country that are not too happy about that, and I think that they're not unhappy that something like this is leading to destabilization of the EU. Also, there's a very important oil pipeline that's being built from the Caspian Sea to northern Turkey, and of course we know that's big bucks, so that's the U.S. government wants to keep its finger in the pie by having these bases over there, and of course it's always a knife to the throat of the Russians too in case they get excited. So I usually the humanitarian reasons for anything are something that they use to as an excuse, but the main thing, follow the money.
Basically, you're saying they have a vested interest in it,
though. Almost everything that the government does has a vested interest, and then usually they use humanitarianism as an excuse for their vested interest at activity.
I see. Now, did you happen to see 60 Minutes 2 last night?
No, I missed that.
Okay, they had a really good segment on Slobodan Milosevic, and for most of us who don't know much about him, pretty much explained the man, and basically how he came to be where he is. There was the Kosovo province was 90% Albanian, and they claim there that the Serbs were being treated as second-class citizens, and of course that's wrong.
Yes.
And the president of the country, or prime minister, whatever he was, I've forgotten his title, was going to go up there to a meeting to address their grievances, and instead he sent Slobodan Milosevic. Well, in the middle of the meeting, the Serbs start to riot.
Oh.
So he goes out to see what's going on, and I must say, I admire his huevos here. He waded into the crowd and said, "What's going on here?" And they told him, "We are being beaten. The Albanians beat us, the police beat us." And with one sentence, he changed the whole picture for Yugoslavia. He said, "No one is allowed to beat you," and of course he became their champion, and he deposed the man who sent him up there to begin with.
Yes.
And a man that knew him very well came over here and to escape communism in Yugoslavia in the early 50s, and then went back and had a place in the government. And he says that whatever Milosevic is doing now, he does strictly so he can stay in power.
Well, I don't think that's odd for any world leader. I think whether it's Clinton or Tony Blair, any of these people, as politicians, they will do nearly anything to stay in power. I think the problem here is that the United States government has backed dictators and semi-dictators all over the world, and still does. However, it seems that this man has tripped the traces, and he's not a good dictator. He's a bad dictator. So it all depends on the whims of the people in Washington.
Well, you're probably...
The other thing is this. We have the same situation that could happen here in this country as millions of mestizos from Mexico and South cross our borders, and finally we say, no way. But by that time, half the state of California could be 90% Mexican or whatever, and then what do we do? Now, according to my understanding, just lately, the United States has signed a treaty with the United Nations. It says if any mass of people cross your borders, you're required not to remove them forcibly, and you must even feed and clothe them. So it would seem to me that the United States policy is now to really break up cultures and systems around the world, even our own. I mean, we want to get these illegal aliens out, but it's obvious that the federal government doesn't want them out.
Okay, but as far as, and I mean, even if it does, and I think that may be stretching a little, become 90%. Mexican immigrants, wouldn't it be a fact that because they are illegal immigrants, they couldn't vote anyway? So they're certainly not going to get any of their representatives.
Well, there also, you got to remember, there's so much illegal voting going on now by this motor voter thing that where it's very easy for almost anybody to vote and not get caught, whether legal or illegal. And they've exposed this here in California with very large numbers of people who shouldn't have been able to vote. But even then, when you move a mass of people, say I took, if I took 10,000 people and infiltrated them into one state, say in Mexico, gradually filling up the state with American whites, pretty soon I would have enough money there and so forth that I would demand more representation, and one thing leads to another. And of course, the Mexican people, they have their champions that are moving into politics now, and that's the way it works. You know, it's called conquest by immigration.
Well, isn't that basically that's the way this country was built? I mean, white Europeans came over here and took the country away from the Indians, so who are descendants of those people today to decry the same thing happening through a legal voting process?
Well, that may be all be true, but it doesn't have to be that way. In other words, I've been warning for 20 years or more than 20 years that you cannot let this happen because it's going to change the whole structure of the United States and our culture and our Western civilization into something that we don't know exactly how it's going to end up, but it's not going to be what it's been for hundreds of years in this country.
Well, I don't I don't think it certainly wouldn't upset me if we had, I mean, we've had Hispanics here and elected to every office here, governor and congressman and so forth, and I certainly didn't upset me. There wasn't any kind of change or wasn't any radical departure from the norms that we knew. And now we've got you. We've got you whiteys in the sights. Things are going to change. That didn't happen.
Well, that's because initially most of these Hispanic, so-called Hispanic people, are controlled by white money. But as they get more and more power and they get up really over you, you're going to find out. If you want to know what your future is in a country, you look at where the bulk of the people are coming from and look what kind of government they have there. They will transfer all the problems of Mexico into this country eventually. And we will become a banana republic of some sorts, and we will be second rate to the European Union.
But don't you think that... I don't think it's true in all cases, but for the most part, you've got to be head and shoulders above the crowd to get elected. I mean, you're not going to get elected if you're some rabble-rousing dummy. So,
well,
I don't really. And you've got to keep one thing in mind, sir. New Mexico is one of two states that whites are, in fact, in the minority.
Yes,
we're a minority in this state, and there, you know, that it just hasn't happened here.
Well, it hasn't happened yet, but it'll gradually get to that point, and you'll see then an exodus of whites out of the state, and you'll see a lot of things changing. When people don't, they have a majority maybe in numbers, they don't have a majority in holding the capital and the money in the state, and as long the white elite that have the money and hold the reins will control the leaders pretty much of the mestizo or Hispanic community, or the leaders at least. But as time goes on and California and the other states swing more and more that way, you're going to see a whole different face on these so-called Hispanics. I don't like to use the term Hispanic because there are many good white Hispanics out there. And it simply means someone who has their origins in the Iberian Peninsula of Spain. And there's many good white people in Spain, and there's many white people who come here from Cuba, but there's what I call them mestizos, the mixed bloods, and that's where the problem is.
Oh, well, I married one, and I didn't. There wasn't a problem there. You know, I don't know what you're talking about.
Well, these things are collective and long range. It doesn't mean every little situation there's going to be a war, there's going to be a problem, or she's going to knife you in the middle of the night. And it has nothing really to do with good or evil. It's just a numbers game, that's all. That if one group, whether it's white or whoever it is, has the power, they should use it in their favor. I respect the mestizos for going for it. And I say if the white population are so stupid that they're going to let not only mestizos but Asians, everyone else, come in here and sit down, and also the whites bring their birth rate down to about zero, then we deserve to lose everything. And, of course, a lot of people say, well, I don't care. I'm old. That's my grandchildren's problems. But I don't feel that way. I think I owe something to my offspring.
Okay, now, assuming that this, and I look at it as nothing more than hysteria, that it does happen, and let's say that one of these mestizos does become president of the United States, is he going to say, okay, the first thing he's going to do is wipe out the Constitution,
No. Which
guarantees every American equal protection under the law? How is that going to
No, happen? The first ones that make it, whether they're black or mestizo or what, they're going to be controlled just like the ones that are whites that are in there now by primarily elitist transnational corporation money, and that'll go along for a certain length of time, but as the miscegenation and the increased numbers increase and the older elites die off and this financial system passes into the hands of non-whites, then you'll see the picture change. It takes a while. This stuff, I forget what they used to call it. There's a fast socialism and a slow socialism. And I think that we're under the gun of slow socialism, international socialism. I'm not so much against national socialism as long as it benefits the people and the workers of the country. But we're doing everything in this country, it seems today, is oriented against the average white person, the average worker. Then your business is no different. As time passes, you'll be replaced by mestizo people. Then radio stations are changing over to Latin Mexican formats. I mean, it's just the way it goes. And I said 20 years ago this is what was going to happen if you didn't stop it. But they haven't done anything to stop it.
You know, I remember the same kind of rhetoric back when JFK ran for the presidency, and everything was going to be in favor of Catholics, and Protestants are doomed, and oh no, what are we going to do? Don't vote for this guy. Well, of course, he was elected, and nothing changed. It just wasn't true.
Well, that's true in that sense, but he was only in there a couple of hundred days, wasn't it? But the point is that as time goes on and the numbers build, they will use their muscle and push themselves around, and that's just it.
I just don't see that happening.
Well, I wouldn't respect them if they didn't, because since I'm a little bit of a survival of the fittest type, I respect any life form that reaches out and takes what it feels it needs and wants. And so I wouldn't respect a Hispanic or a mestizo if they didn't go for the power and the money. I have more respect for the Aztlan people than I do the middle-of-the-road whites and Mexicans, because it's the bold and the people who are aggressive that usually end up running the show.
Now, let me ask you something, Tom. Don't you think that not just here, but don't you think the whole world would be a better place if everyone just really looked hard at the race question? And by the race question, I mean the human race. And just said that's what we all are. We are all humans, and left it at that. Wouldn't things be a whole lot less complicated?
Well, it might be a nice religion, but it breaks down when you analyze it closely. And it just does, these things don't work. This is utopianism, and it does not work. Man is aggressive. Man is territorial. Man is clannish. Man is going to stay that way. And what we see in the world today, most of the violence coming on, is because ethnic, cultural, and racial people want their own turf. And they end up fighting a central government to get it. I mean, you see it there in Albania with the FLA. You know, they squatted there so long they think it's theirs, and they want it. And that's the danger of letting people squat very long. Then they want the whole picture. But all over the world, from Tamira and all the areas around the world, you see separatist causes going ahead, and a central government trying to hold it together. Well, all these big, strong central governments are losing it. and we're going to be balkanized here in the United States along racial and economic lines.
And have you, can you name any instances right now that point toward that here in this country?
Well, I just watch at the representation of these groups that have come in, like the mestizos, and see more and more the political parties are pandering to them. The Democrat Party, especially here in California, but the Republican Party now is trying to get into the act. The Republican Party, of course, to me, has ended up sort of like the Whigs. I think they're on the way out because they got no cojones. And if they would stand up and fight like they should for the principles they talk about, the Republican Party would be a strong party, but it's not. And so when there's a vacuum, something will always replace it, and it'll be the more radical elements that replace it.
You know, why is it, Tom, I fail to understand this, that as I said, we are a Hispanic majority in this state. We do share a border with Mexico, and the only time I hear the term mestizos is when I have you on, and then there was one other guy that basically made the same claims that you do. But why isn't, you know, we don't even hear that term here? Why?
Well, that's because it's sort of they've tried to gloss over with this term Hispanic. And if you'll talk to any white Spaniard, say some Cuban that's a white Spaniard background, he just grits his teeth when you call these mestizos Hispanic. I call them accurately what they should be called. That term comes from a sheep that's grown in Mexico and South, and it's a sheep that has many colors in its wool. In other words, a hybrid, a mixed race people is what a mestizo is, and that's what they are. And so I'm being very accurate when I call them mestizos. In fact, it's not absolutely a pejorative term. Is an accurate description of what they are. But they're not Hispanics. Just because they speak Spanish doesn't make them Spanish. Now, my kids used to get on the bus, and they say, well, the whole bus was full of Spanish people. And I said, they're not Spanish, they're mestizo. Most true Spaniards wouldn't have too much to do with them.
I don't know. I haven't seen that here, Tom, and I really don't think we're going to, but you may be right. Years down the road, that may happen, but I just, if it is, it's certainly a very slow process at the present.
Well, you know as well as I do, most guys, when they go out and they find a lady, they're going to find a light Mexican lady with many times very Anglo features, maybe like a little suntan and like that, and they're quite attractive. And that's the ones they mate with. They usually don't mate with these short, squat Guatemalans and stuff like that. They pick out the whitest-looking Mexicans.
Oh. Well, I don't know. I think I recall, actually, I did mate with a short, squat Guatemalan.
That's typical of a white man. I tell you, you know, where he carries his brain, you know.
Yeah, well, I can't deny that.
That's one of our big problems in this country, and I think it's an insult, really, to a white womanhood, and I think it's very it's an insult to the black ladies in the country, the way their black men go whoring after white women. I think it's atrocious.
Well, couldn't it be that maybe the people just loved each other and didn't really take into consideration that society frowned upon it?
Oh, no. I think some people go out of their way to get involved in that kind of stuff. And even, you know, remember when Bobby Seale wrote in his book that impregnating a white woman was a revolutionary act? There's a lot of young black men who not only want to have the sex with white women, but they feel it's invading the white man's domain. There's sort of a hang-up on that, so a lot of it's that. And let's face it, most of your relationships start out with lust, and they may grow into love, but they start out with lust. But I wish all the white ladies that like black men and mestizo men would just wear a little badge on their blouse when they go out and maybe go into a bar and say, I love Negroes or I love mestizos, so that us white guys who don't go along with that will be forewarned, because I have a lot of white guys that write me and call me and say, you know, I found this real nice white gal, and then I found out that she'd been living with a black man, and, you know, and they're very upset. So I think everybody should if you're liberal and you're espousing that race mixing, that you should be proud of it and wear a little badge.
Well, let's go one step further, and absolutely, among the worst race of people, certainly in the 20th century, were the Nazis. So let's get all the descendants of Nazis to wear a little badge. My grandfather was a stormtrooper, because after all, who would want those kind of genes in their children?
The same genes that that Beethoven's genes came from.
The same genes that slaughtered 66 million Jews.
Well, we've done our, this country, this government has done its share of slaughtering, and many other countries, and there are going to be a lot more slaughtered before it's all over again. I think history is going to be somewhat rewritten as time goes on as far as the German situation, especially the cooperation between Adolf Eichmann making his deal with the Zionists to move the German Jews out of Germany into Palestine so the Zionists could take over Palestine. They struck a medal with it, with the Star of David on one side and a swastika on the other. So if you start looking back in history, and then, of course, the United States, they weren't allowing these Jews in unless a lot of them snuck in, and they used various ways to get in through Canada and so forth. Hardly any country in the world wanted to take the Jews. So I think that everybody had better look at their situation before they start just hammering on the Germans.
Not Germans, Tom. I'm going to make a distinction there, because there are many fine German people, as there were during World War II. We have to draw a line there and say Nazis.
Well, why don't you do the same thing with the Japanese? You'd simply say Japanese, or even the soldiers that fought in World War II, but they were part of a military Shinto class, and why don't we say those dirty Shintos? No, we say Japanese. How come in all the movies and everything it's the Nazis? I mean, everybody was a Nazi. You know, in most countries, only about 10-20% maximum ever belonged to a political party anyhow, and the rest of the people just get swept along. But I go out on a limb and I argue in favor of many things that the German people did during World War II, or especially before World War II, when they took a country out of eating out of garbage cans all the way back up to the top. And we know now, of course, we should know that a lot of that problem that England had with Germany and so forth was economic. England has always been upset with any competitor in Europe. They play one against the other, and so. But let's face it, World War I, which we never should have been involved in, led us into World War II. There never would have been a World War II if there hadn't been a World War I. So when Woodrow Wilson, like the normal lying politician, FDR and all of them, I'm not going to take your sons into war. They all lie and take your sons into war. And I think Americans are warmongers. I really believe that. When I heard a poll taken yesterday that 74% of the people okayed a land war in the Balkans, I said, what is this? I mean, this is insane. We are not the policemen of the world. There's nowhere in our Constitution that says that the government of the United States has a right to be an imperialist nation, moving all over the world, policing people, and calling a peace a peacekeeping force. This is straight-out imperialism. That's all it is.
Well, and then, of course, there are those of us that say, well, we can't just stand by and let these people be slaughtered.
Well, then what are you going to do? You're going to take the entire budget of the United States running everywhere in the world, from Rwanda to North Korea to every place where people are dying? I think every time we get into these things, more people die. I believe that a lot more people are dying because we're there, not just because we're bombing, but because when we started bombing, we infuriated the Serbs, and they said, well, hell, now we're really pissed, and we're going to run them all out of the country. And now I see on the morning news where the Yugoslavs yesterday sealed the border, and they're attacked for that. Say, wait a minute. One minute you're after us because we're pushing them out of the country, and now you're mad at us because we're keeping them in. You can't satisfy these people.
Well, I did notice that, too. Tom, we've gone far longer than I anticipated, but you're always an interesting guest on here, and I suspect we will talk again, sir, and I have to sign off now.
Yeah, Seamus.
But I do appreciate your taking the time to talk to us.